This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira is on vacation this week. Later this hour, we'll talk about new experiments in biology aboard the International Space Station, plus how sports teams are managing their COVID-19 risk. But first, another chapter in the story of the coveted COVID-19 vaccine. Here in the U.S., pharmaceutical company Moderna began the third and longest phase of human trials this week, which will assess a candidate vaccine for both safety and effectiveness. But scientists in Russia are also working on a vaccine candidate, and this week it was reported that Russian officials hope to roll out that vaccine as soon as August 10th. Here with more on that story, plus other short subjects in science, is my guest, Maggie Kurth, a senior science writer for 538. She joins me from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Welcome back to the show, Maggie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Timelines are optimistic if they say we're going to get a new vaccine by sometime next year. So how are Russian scientists saying they're already ready to distribute one in less than 2 weeks?
Well, all of the vaccines that are far ahead in this process are sort of built on the framework of existing vaccines. That one that is going into phase three trials this week in the U.S. is based on a pre-existing vaccine for MERS, related to the COVID virus. And the same thing is true of this Russian vaccine. But one of the ways that they are getting around this is by kind of skipping some of the steps in the testing process. So right now, this vaccine is in phase two trials. It's not actually done with phase two trials yet. And they're planning on running the third phase at the same time that they're broadly distributing it to frontline healthcare workers. So this is something where a lot of scientists are expressing some concerns about the actual safety and efficacy of this vaccine. And at the same time, they haven't made any of the scientific data publicly available yet. It's not been up for peer review. It's not been released to the scientific community in any way. They're saying that that's something that's going to happen soon, but it hasn't happened yet. So Russian officials are calling this their Sputnik moment, which of course is kind of referencing the idea that they're surprising us and beating us to the punch. But there's a lot of questions about whether it's a good idea that they're doing that or not.
It seems as though it might not be a good idea, but let's get to the Sputnik moment for a second here. I mean, is it right to characterize this race as a new kind of space race between Russia and the U.S.?
Well, it could be, yeah. You know, this is a really strange world for vaccines right now. It's not typical for these things to have this kind of political aspect that they seem to be having. Russia has already been accused of trying to hack databases in the US and other countries to steal vaccine secrets. Science had a really great story this week on vaccine nationalism. So you have all of these wealthy countries that are already developing private deals with vaccine manufacturers and kind of buying up all of the orders of these vaccines that don't even exist yet in advance. And it's starting to kind of stoke fears that low-risk average Joes in the US and Europe are going to get vaccinated long before frontline healthcare workers can in poorer countries. So there are all of these different ways that the vaccine race is becoming political. And this, you know, these Russian officials talking about this as a Sputnik moment is just one aspect of that.
Hey, real quick, before we move off this subject, I'm wondering if we can talk more about what we might do to make sure that whatever vaccine comes out of this from Russia, US, or wherever gets to poorer countries where it's really going to be needed.
There are programs that are supposed to be doing this, and different groups are trying to get countries to sign on to it, but they're having a lot of resistance. And it's something that is really a concern because we've seen similar problems play out with AIDS drugs in the past. You know, it is a issue where when there's a serious problem, the rich countries just don't necessarily want to share.
So let's move to a different note here. Researchers have found some microbes at the very bottom of the ocean, microbes that it turns out are pretty old. Okay, how old are they, Maggie?
Oh my God, this is so cool. Okay, so scientists drilled these cores of seafloor sediment out of the South Pacific, you know, thousands of feet below the surface of the ocean. And they extracted bacteria from this clay and muck And they got these bacteria, which were hunkered down, seemingly dead, in sediments 100 million years old, to start growing and dividing again.
That's amazing.
So, yeah.
Do they know how they got there in the first place?
Well, these are probably bacteria that got trapped in sediment as it was forming, hundreds of millions of years ago. And they are oxygen-dependent species, but they've been living in this environment that is extremely low oxygen. You know, they're basically surviving on this tiny amount of oxygen isotopes that are diffusing through the seabed from deep below. There's very little food for them to eat. So basically, this is a confirmation that bacteria are even more hardy than we had already guessed. You know, we know they can live in these very hot environments. We know they can live in very cold. And now we know that they can live without much food or energy for eons, even though they need it. So scientists don't know what the bacteria were doing down there all this time. They may have been slowly dividing or just frozen in time. And they represent a diverse group of species and subspecies. You know, it's not just one particular organism. Basically, life finds a way.
Is there something big that we can learn about our planet or basic biology, you think, from finding these microbes way at the bottom of the ocean?
It tells us something very important about the tenacity of life and where life can live and what it can do. And this is definitely one of the first times we've been able to like wake up something this old. And that matters for understanding of how biology works and what we might be able to find, you know, maybe even on Mars. Hint, hint about a future story.
Speaking of Mars, very nice segue there, Maggie. NASA's Perseverance rover launched yesterday morning. And so if all goes well, it'll be joining Curiosity on Mars sometime in February. Seems like pretty exciting times for planetary science.
Yeah. And over at Science News, reporter Lisa Grossman had this really interesting story about how the scientists prepped for that mission. So back in February, the seven scientists were walking around the Nevada desert, essentially cosplaying as the rover so that they could give its instruments a trial run before launch. Perseverance is the most ambitious mission to Mars that we've had. And it's scheduled to take 20 samples of Martian rocks, store them, prepare them for return to Earth. It's supposed to do all that in its first 2 years. That's nothing we've ever done before in the past with rovers. And so the scientists really wanted to make sure these tools worked and that they could send back the information that we wanted them to be able to send. So they had this offsite team scattered all over the world, pretending to be, you know, mission control on Earth. And then these scientists were carrying around the handheld versions of Perseverance's tools and following the commands of mission control to make sure that everything operated the way it's supposed to operate.
I think one of the best things about this launch yesterday is that, I don't know about you, but it's kind of nice to look forward to something happening potentially in February. There might be some good news. It might be something to look forward to that has nothing to do with any of the stuff happening on Earth.
Right? It would be really great to like watch a landing in February and have that kind of communal experience. You know, the last times we've had rovers land, people got really excited and there were actually, you know, people sort of turning out to watch this thing communally. Well, I guess we won't be able to do that exactly anymore, but being able to have a shared experience seems really nice right about now.
Yeah, let's look forward to maybe being a little bit more communal than we are right now.
Yeah.
But, let's turn to one last story here and some revelations that were news to me. First, news that the Pentagon has an office for investigating UFOs, and it now has a new report coming out soon. So tell us about this.
The New York Times is reporting that these records from a Senate committee report that happened last month have been released and are showing that this secretive Pentagon UFO investigation program that was supposedly scrapped years ago is still in operation. Instead of being shut down, it was renamed and transferred over to the Naval Intelligence Office. So now it's called the Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon Task Force, and which is a lot. And its goal is to basically standardize collection and reporting on sightings of unexplained aerial vehicles. So if you think about like those grainy cockpit videos you might have seen in the last couple of years where you had F-16s like spotting these strange ships in the sky. And what is more, according to this committee report, the task force is set to report at least some of its findings to the public within 180 days of the passage of the Intelligence Authorization Act. So this task force began in 2007. It was supposed to have been shut down in 2012, but rumors have been circulating for years that it's still up and running. And technically, it's not really looking for little green people. What it's actually looking for is evidence that other countries have developed high-tech aircraft that they're using in our airspace. Or at least that's what it's officially doing. Some of its fans, which include former Senator Harry Reid, really are hoping that it's going to find evidence of alien visitation. And there are, you know, astronomers, there are astrobiologists, there are like all of these people involved as scientist contractors who are working with this team and like trying to understand what's going on.
So how seriously should we take that piece of it? Obviously, there's a military interest in figuring out whether or not other countries are flying over the U.S. with weird new vehicles. But how seriously should we take this search for little green men, as you put it?
I think it's important to kind of have these sort of groups that are looking into those kind of things, because having some transparency to that, having, you know, it not just be a thing that people tell you they don't want you to know about, is, I think, valuable. And so getting these reports out there, having some of this information coming out, I guess, hypothetically, relatively soon, you know, I think that's useful and it's bound to be interesting.
Well, I guess it gives us something else to look forward to.
Yeah.
we're out of time. Thanks so much to Maggie Kurth, a senior science writer for 538 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thanks, Maggie.
Mm-hmm.